This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. When Illinois voters head to the polls between now and November 8th, they'll be deciding on more than representation and leadership. Also on the ballot this year is Amendment 1, dubbed by supporters as the Workers' Rights Amendment. If Amendment 1 is ratified, it would make organizing and collective bargaining a constitutional right for Illinois workers. Illinois would be only the fourth state in the U.S. to lock similar labor protections into its constitution. And with the election less than a week away, we're looking back at our conversation into what the amendment would mean for Illinois with two perspectives on the proposal. I was joined by Dr. Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, an associate professor in Loyola University Chicago's History Department. She specializes in the history of labor movements and capitalism. We were also joined by Miley Smith, the director of labor policy and a staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute, a libertarian and pro-business anti-tax think tank. Because this part of the show is on tape, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org, or tweet us @21stshow. So, Elizabeth, I'm going to begin with you, and let's just talk about some of the language in Amendment 1. In addition to that sort of basic right to organize and collectively bargain, what else is in there, right? There's the phrase economic welfare. Maybe we can start with that.
I think it's a really exciting amendment for exactly that idea about sort of putting this a question about rights and really highlighting that the union rights that we've been having since 1935 have always actually been about democracy on the job and recognizing these as basic citizenship rights, both on the job and that they have real importance actually to our lives off the job, our ability to have the hours capable so we can actually participate in elections, to actually have the wages to do, the wages also to sort of, you know, consume, keep our houses, buy our houses, all these other kinds of things. So it's a really exciting, you know, reminder about how important these basic workplace rights are.
And do you think that, I mean, how much beyond the scope of, right, traditional wages and benefits would you think that this constitutional amendment would possibly reach?
I think one of the things that's really interesting about all the different things that unions have traditionally bargained for are actually better workplace safety, that they've been a real sort of impetus to actually make sure so that you can see that there's a way that this could actually just improve the overall quality of workplaces in Illinois, which would be a big draw bringing people here. So I'm really excited by that.
All right, Miley, what about your perspective? What do you think about the effects of this, if this constitutional amendment is passed, maybe bargaining goes beyond simply wages and benefits that's locked in some ways. What do you think, broadly speaking, would be the effects of this passing in Illinois?
I think everyone can agree that workers deserve great protections. You know, that's not a left issue, right issue. Everyone can agree. But that's not Amendment 1. Amendment 1 is actually a first of its kind constitutional amendment that the effects are pretty drastic. It will drive up taxes and will cement Illinois' reputation as one of the worst places to do business. And that's because when you split up this amendment, and it has four provisions, and the first grants a fundamental right to unionize, but it can only apply to government employees. While it's framed as applying to all employees, legally it can only apply to government employees because the federal government already regulates private sector collective bargaining. And the Supreme Court has been clear that when the through the National Labor Relations Act, because of that, states can't then come in and also regulate. So this has been misframed. It is a fundamental right only for government workers. And it also expands bargaining for government unions beyond wages and benefits. Like you pointed out, those are the traditional subjects of bargaining. We already have rights to negotiate for those in Illinois, but it adds these broad new subjects like economic welfare. And we have seen unions in Illinois try to expand their bargaining powers, government unions, like Chicago Teachers Union has argued for the expansion of affordable housing or positions on rent abatement. Those aren't things that affect the workers or provide more protection or safety protection for workers. Those are things that cost money to the taxpayers. And then it prohibits lawmakers from ever fixing that. So if lawmakers later on down the line realize, wow, we expanded bargaining far beyond what we intended to, they can't go back and limit it and say, oh, we didn't mean for it to include this subject. They can't restrict the right to strike for government workers to go out and strike in order to get demands met. And they can't even limit the length of contracts if this amendment passes. And we've seen 10-year contracts in the state of Illinois. The only provision that applies is the ban on right to work, which is in the last part. That's the only part that applies, I'm sorry, to the private sector. And they're contrary to what the proponents are saying, we've looked at every single state constitution. No state constitutions have any of these provisions, let alone all four of them. And like I said, among the many consequences, it's going to drive up taxes. Government union contracts already cost money.
Yeah, I want to dig into
I'd like to come back. Can I?
Yeah, no, sure. And I do want to dig into some of those points.
So first off, let's actually talk about the federal and the state provisions, because actually where the idea that you could even pass a right to work law is actually in the 1947 amendments to the original Labor Relations Act, 1935, is to actually say that states decide. So there's actually a lot of power at the local and state level in terms of actually sort of shaping the labor regulations, and particularly towards unions that they have. That's always been the case. And I think the thing that I'm a little worried about is there's a lot of sort of whipsawing about, oh, your taxes are going to go up. Well, we actually don't know what's going to be in these union contracts. We don't know at all. And also, again, concerns about a 10-year contract. One thing to think about is actually maybe a 10-year contract would be good for both employers and employees in actually the state of Illinois, because contract, you've got a good stability. We're not going to go right back into contract negotiations in 2 to 3 years down the line. This is actually a much more complex issue. And also for this question about who it applies for, well, I think what's actually going to be happening, like so much of American labor policy, it's going to go right fighting out into the courts. And, you know, Maile Smith brought up the question of the Supreme Court. Also got to watch that National Labor Relations Board going on here. And right now we've actually seen an NLRB, that's what it stands for, National Labor Relations Board, who are actually taking a proactive step to actually protect the ability of workers in the private sector to actually organize. We're seeing this with Starbucks, we're seeing with this Apple. So we're really sort of showing that actually Illinois is right in this frothy mix about trying to figure out what basic rights people have on the job.
The Supreme Court has actually been very clear on that. And it's not, the precedent's not on proponent's side. The National Labor, they have stated that the National Labor Relations Act preempts any state law that would regulate, this is the quote, regulate any activity that the NLRA protects, prohibits, or arguably protects or prohibits. That's a 1986 case. And the Seventh Circuit has also agreed that a state law is preempted by the a state law preempted by the National Labor Relations Act violates the U.S. Constitution. As I said, the only provision that could apply to the private sector is the right to work provision. And as Dr. Shermer pointed out, there is a carve out in the National Labor Relations Act only for right to work. And exactly, I agree, we don't know what is going to be in these labor contracts, just like Dr. Mm-hmm. Shermer said.
Okay, we need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have the rest of our conversation on the Workers' Rights Amendment. My guests were Dr. Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, Associate Professor in the History Department at Loyola University Chicago, and Maile Smith, Director of Labor Policy and a staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For the rest of the program today, we're listening back to our conversation on Amendment 1, or the Workers' Rights Amendment, which is going to be on the ballot between now and next Tuesday, Election Day. We're talking about what it would mean for Illinois if it passes. Our guests were Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, Associate Professor in the History Department at Loyola University Chicago. She specializes in the history of labor movements and capitalism. Also, Maile Smith, Director of Labor Policy and a staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute, a right-leaning think tank. Because this part of the show is on tape, we're not taking calls, but as ever, you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org, or tweet us at 21st Show. Elizabeth, let me start with you. I think that we probably can't understand where this amendment is coming from without talking about the 4 years that Republican Bruce Rauner was governor of Illinois and made weakening most government employee unions central to his agenda. Can you draw that out for us?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that what I think I'd like to actually put it not just in the context of Illinois, but also the Midwest in general, because we've really only been finding right to work restrictions, especially for public employees in southern and western states, all passed before 1958 through voter referendum, usually, and to be honest, and these are the states that are flagged for the real serious violations of the Voting Rights Amendment of 1965, 7 years later. But here in the Midwest, we've had this sort of war on unionism that has actually not been done by public vote, but actually through heavily gerrymandered legislatures. And I think it was this with Governor Rauner really seeing this, like so many of our neighboring states, that this was a way of actually sort of, like in right to work states, weakening everyday people's power at the ballot box. It's been so important. And I think that that really helps it. And also sort of trying to sort of weaken the ability of everyday people working these jobs to have a say in their workplaces. And I think that that's really what it comes down to.
Miley, briefly, what's your perspective? I mean, I think there's a simple way of looking at this and saying, look, Bruce Rauner went up against the legislature. We had a 2-year budget impasse, mainly over this issue of whether to weaken the collective bargaining rights of government employees. He lost to the Democratic legislature, and this is the Democrats coming back and saying, let's not have that particular fight again. How do you respond to that?
I think that that is partially what is going on. Of course, we haven't had a Republican in office for 4 years. So there has been 4 years of what we have seen the legislature doing is granting more power to government unions here in Illinois. Where I think this comes from is that government unions in Illinois have been losing members. Since 2017, government unions in Illinois have lost almost 9% of their membership, and that includes almost 10% of teacher members. And when they're losing membership, that's a scary thing to them. It signals to them that they're losing their power over their members, and they have to get that back somewhere. And it's through this amendment. This amendment will allow government unions to expand their bargaining to cover their agendas. It doesn't provide any more rights that will help workers. They already have the right to bargain. They have the right to bargain over wages, hours, terms and conditions of employment. This allows unions like Chicago Teachers Union to bargain for their social agendas, to argue for things like I mentioned, housing assistance and rent abatement, things that don't necessarily help their membership. And I think they're seeing that their members are upset, and so they're trying to cement their power over the people and over lawmakers in a different way now.
Just a quick reminder is that actually that unions are people, and they're actually made up of actually those who are actually working in these places. So I think that that's a really important thing to sort of aspect of this sort of question. And I think it's really gets it sort of muddled is that, we don't know what's actually are going to be in these contracts, but the sort of more basic question about, will you sort of send a signal that this is a place where you can expect to actually have your rights on the job protected at the state level. And again, I'm going to say it, like everything that has to deal with American labor law, it's going to go right out into the courts. That's the way that it has, is like, this is just, you know, a statement. And to me, it actually sort of fits with some of the other more progressive things that is happening in Illinois as sort of a statement about what the state stands for.
Yeah, and I mean, totally unions have been, unions have been working beyond just for their membership, right? They have been arguing for higher minimum wages. You know, they lobby the legislature for things that don't just affect their members. Let me ask, because you, Miley mentioned this declining membership, and certainly declining union membership broadly across the economy has been a story for decades. But there was, in 2018, this Supreme Court decision, Janus versus AFSCME, a U.S. Supreme Court case, that came out of Illinois. And would this amendment have, and I should say, the summary of that is that basically if you could work for the government, if you were in a collective bargaining union, you were represented by a union, you either had to join or pay what are called fair share fees. This said that was unconstitutional. It violated the free speech rights of members not to associate with the unions. Would this constitutional amendment, and I'll ask Elizabeth first, would this constitutional amendment do anything to change that situation?
The answer would be no, because again, as Maile Smith brought up, like, you know, that is a Supreme Court kind of precedence. And with that rule in place, it would not actually sort of do that. So this question of the fair share fees, and there are restrictions in terms of what unions are able to do. And I'm sorry to get in the weeds, but the technical term of this is the maintenance of the membership clauses is what we're sort of dealing into. And that's where the idea of the fair share fees is, that you need sort of to, even if you're not a union member, you're being covered by the contract, you need to pay your fair share. And that money can't actually go to unions' political activities at all.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. With a general election less than a week away, we're revisiting our conversation on Amendment 1, or the Workers' Rights Amendment, talking about what it would mean for Illinois. Our guests were Dr. Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, an associate professor in Loyola University Chicago's History Department. She specializes in the history of labor movements and capitalism. We were also joined by Miley Smith, the director of labor policy and a staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute, a conservative to libertarian think tank. Miley, I want to come back to this idea. You said taxes are going to go up, and I know one of your colleagues at the Policy Institute, Bryce Hill, I think, had a piece a while back called Amendment 1 would guarantee $2,100 property tax hike for typical Illinois family. Can you walk us through that? How does the math on that work?
Yeah, and I think this is actually the beginning of this is an area where Dr. Shermer and I agree. We don't know what is going to be in these contracts. And that is what makes this amendment so dangerous, particularly since it prohibits lawmakers from ever deciding what goes in these contracts. Government contracts already cost money. So for example, the 2019 CTU contract, the total annual cost of that contract is $2.6 billion in its final year, according to the Chicago Tribune. So these contracts already cost money. But Amendment 1 will lead to increased government union demands, right? There's this unlimited unknown through this amendment. We don't know what all they could demand now. That's going to increase the cost of government. And when government increases, the cost of government increases, that's passed on to the taxpayers. And that's what's at stake. And
the argument here is I understand, unions will have more power. They can ask for more money from the government. Therefore, property taxes will go up. Is that
exactly
the argument?
And they have a permanent right to strike to get those demands met. You know, while there's two sides at the table, it's only government unions that have the ability to walk out and put government to a stop, denying services to people in order to get their demands met.
Elizabeth, this is a great. Well, let me ask Elizabeth. Let me ask about this, because this is often an argument I hear from that from the side that opposes the power of government employee unions. They cite Franklin Roosevelt, you know, himself said the government unions were not a good idea or something. I hear that talking point. Maybe this is a good opportunity for you to weigh in on that and that history of government employee unions compared to the private sector.
Do you want to emphasize? Our taxpayers too. So let's just keep that in mind. And I think for me, this is like some of the really important work that we know now, that one of the reasons there was an effort, if you look at the original Wagner Act, 1935 National Labor Relations Act, it excludes those working in public employment, agricultural and domestic. And the reason they were excluded, agricultural and domestic workers were excluded, it was a way to get Southerners to actually pass this law, because it was basically going to exclude African-Americans. And in the West, it actually excluded many other people of color, the more multicultural Western states. Public employee unions, this was actually a way of stopping the many public employees who happen to be Jews and Catholics, recent immigrants. So it actually is kind of baked into that sort of systemic racism, very similar to when I was mentioning before, that a lot of these early right to work laws are passed in those Southern Western states, where there really just wasn't the same voting rights to actually empower those who are the most disenfranchised. So for me, going back to this, why this question of public employees were excluded from the first place, and this fear about it really goes into some of those the xenophobia, the racism that has been a part of policymaking that here in progressive Illinois, we're making steps to address.
Interesting. Just to make sure I can draw out what you're saying there. So I learned in history class that the New Deal was written in such a way to cut out blacks in the South, right? That's you're saying that because a lot of city employees or government employees were Jewish or recent immigrants from Europe, that's why that was excluded along the same lines.
Absolutely. This is the new work by the amazing historian Will Jones up at the University of Minnesota. It's really important in adding this dimension, because you're right. Most textbooks, first off, they leave the entire American West out, where we also had Asian farm workers, Chicano farm workers, all sorts of things. But also kind of forgot to mention this public employee thing, and also highlighting that so many of the people who were finding work in these public employee jobs were those who were struggling in the private sector, the steel industry, things like that, the better paying jobs.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. With a general election less than a week away, we're revisiting our conversation on Amendment 1, or the Workers' Rights Amendment, talking about what it would mean for Illinois. Our guests were Dr. Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, an associate professor in Loyola University Chicago's History Department. She specializes in the history of labor movements and capitalism. We were also joined by Miley Smith, the director of labor policy and a staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute, a conservative to libertarian think tank. Miley, we're almost out of time, but sure. Broadly speaking, we wake up next January, let's say this thing has passed. What is different for the average Illinoisan?
Property taxes. And that is what everyone needs to remember, that this is about government unions. It's not about private sector workers. This is not about my grandfather's union. This is about government sector leaders, government union leaders and their power. And absolutely, I agree. Union members are also taxpayers. But what those union members need to ask themselves before they vote is that tax increase going to be worth giving unions like Chicago Teachers Union more power to push their political agendas in negotiations? Is that more important to them than their property tax increase? Because that's what's at stake. This amendment doesn't give workers any more rights than they already have. It gives government union leaders power to push agendas. And that's going to cost all people in Illinois more money when those contracts go through.
Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, same question to you. If this passes January 1st of next year, what's different for the average Illinoisan?
Well, I think it's going to take time to see. As a historian, it's not going to be this instantaneous. And again, we don't know what's going to be in these contracts. And I also just want to emphasize, just because we keep bringing up the teachers unions, part of the teachers' quote unquote political agenda is actually smaller class sizes that actually better serve our students, better serve young people, better serve the taxpayers' children. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, that some of the things that unions are bargaining for actually benefit all of us at a whole. We are going to be better in Illinois if we have more people able to actually buy homes, to be able to consume, and also if our children have, and this is an important part of teachers' unions' agenda, have fewer numbers of them in a classroom so they can actually get the educational support they need.
Well, this has certainly been an interesting and robust conversation. I hope listeners find that we shed a little more light than heat. I appreciate the passion both of you brought to this. So I will thank Elizabeth and Miley. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st
Show. Thank you. Thank you.
Elizabeth Tandy Shermer is an associate professor at Loyola University Chicago in the History Department. She specializes in the history of labor movements and capitalism. Miley Smith is director of labor policy and a staff attorney at the Illinois Policy Institute, a libertarian think tank. Again, Amendment 1 is going to be on everyone's ballots this year. Broadly speaking, it would make organizing and collective bargaining a constitutional right for Illinois workers. You can check out more about this online. The Secretary of State's office has what is ostensibly a nonpartisan description of what this amendment would and would not do. That conversation was recorded last month. We're listening back to it today because, well, the election is coming up. And coming up on tomorrow's show, a conversation with Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, plus how the cardboard box in your home could be fueling election denial. We'll talk with some ProPublica reporters that linked the owner of a Midwestern shipping supply company with funds to support candidates who are election deniers across the country. And that's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Anaya Jones and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.